Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. College football lovers say they are attracted to it in part because of its traditions, but do they really know what they're talking about? If we are to really understand college football, we must understand its history. The ongoing love-hate relationship between the sport and the academics who feel it marginalizes the importance of education disguises the original marriage of convenience. A new book by an MTSU history professor reveals the true origins of the connection between the university and the gridiron. Dr. Brian Ingracia is the author of The Rise of Gridiron University, Higher Education's Uneasy Alliance with Big-Time Football, and we'll talk to him following a timeout for MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU's membership in Conference USA will begin no later than July 1, 2014. CUSA has 20 intercollegiate sport championships. The league office is located in Irving, Texas. MTSU alumnus Phil Williams, investigative reporter for WTVF-TV in Nashville, was among the 20 initiates inducted into the Omicron Delta Kappa Honor Society November 30th. And finally, the Moroccan American Commission for Educational and Cultural Exchange bestowed a high honor on an MTSU professor November 29th in Morocco. Dr. Ron Messier, a professor of Middle East History and Historical Archaeology and former director of MTSU's University Honors Program, was one of the only two Americans honored for promoting friendship between the U.S. and Morocco. For MTSU News Anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Brian, thanks for being our guest today on MTSU on the Record.
Thanks for having me.
What you say in this book basically is that universities back in the day, taking their cue from the progressive era, accepted football as a way to make college more accessible to the everyday American, for lack of a better term, and less elitist. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's fair. What I argue in the book is that a lot of administrators really saw football as something that would increase the profile of universities, especially make it more appealing to taxpayers. It would help people in states really understand what their tax dollars were going for when they were supporting state universities, for example. There were also some social scientists who said things like football will actually kind of help universities reach out to the people in cities like Chicago, say, who really aren't taking classes at the universities, but they want to have a better idea of what's going on there. It was seen as a way of welcoming people outside of the college walls into campus. And it was also seen as something that would really help out the students. Universities were seen as becoming a little bit intellectually top-heavy at this time, and football was kind of seen as a way to balance that out.
Which is why college football, anyway, began in the Ivy League at some of the most elite schools in the country, Harvard, Yale, Colgate, Brown, Princeton, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the game as we know it, basically, college football started around 1869, right after the Civil War, but it was really invented as we know it in the 1880s at Yale. Walter Camp was instrumental in introducing the downs, line of scrimmage, timing, yard measurements, things like that. And it really became popular first there in the Ivy League, and then as people in other places heard about it, professors moved, you know, they did their PhDs at one place and they would move to another school, the University of Georgia or Auburn. That's really when the sport started to kind of spread out to other places like the South or the Midwest or the West Coast.
John Heisman coached at Auburn, as a matter of fact, didn't he not?
Well, he coached at a lot of places. He's most famous as the coach of Georgia Tech. He was at Clemson before that. Afterwards, he coached at he coached at the University of Pennsylvania, which was his alma mater. He was the first athletic director at Rice University in Houston. He was all over the place.
Did this handshake of sorts between football and colleges coincide with the acceptance of physical education as an academic discipline, or did that come later?
That's actually a really good question. And one of the distinctions I try to make in the book is that physical education and intercollegiate athletics, although at many points in time have been kind of they've been connected in some way. Some of the same people who are teaching physical education are also coaches at this time. They really were different things. And certainly by the late 1800s, physical education was not widely accepted. by many academics. By the early 1900s, it was becoming more accepted, and sometimes there was this kind of marriage of convenience whereby physical education and intercollegiate athletics were put in the same department or the same unit of the university. But even then, there's still a big difference between the two. One is a course room subject for students, and one is really a spectacle that is kind of out there for the public and not just for the students and not just for education.
How did this melding of higher education and football square with the moral underpinnings of sports characteristic of the YMCA, for example?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because the YMCA is part of the what we call the muscular Christianity movement of the late 1800s. There's this kind of general sense that Christianity, religion more generally, can be spread through physical activity. Historians have written about this. And one of the things that we see with football is that it's coming out of kind of the same moment, the same movement. Some of the early coaches, like Amos Alonzo Stagg at the University of Chicago, Harry Williams at the University of Minnesota, they actually were people who started out as people who were interested in the ministry and then decided to kind of focus their ministerial impulses, we might say, into coaching and into teaching young men morality through football. And what you see in a lot of the coaching manuals of the early 1900s is that they stressed this kind of morality, but if you actually kind of look at some of the things they said in other contexts or things that they actually did, it's dubious as to whether or not they were actually really teaching that kind of morality, but they certainly like to tell people that that's what they were doing.
Sort of clean mind, clean body philosophy was where the why was coming from, right?
Yeah, and actually the phrase that a lot of these educators and coaches would have used is they would have used a Latin phrase, mens sana in corpore sana, which means a sound mind in a sound body. They would say you have to have a sound mind or a sound body, rather, in order to have a sound mind. And this is where a lot of the psychologists came into it. They said this is actually going to make the central nervous system stronger, and it's going to help students be able to withstand the rigors of the modern-day curriculum.
We'll take a break here. We'll come back and talk more about college football with Brian Ingracia. This is MTSU on the Record.
Tennessee's farm families contribute to our state's economy, nutrition, and culture. The Tennessee Century Farms program at MTSU's Center for Historic Preservation acknowledges farms that have been in the same family for at least 100 years. To date, the program has certified more than 1,000 farms. This is Kenita Hankins, director of the Tennessee Century Farms program.
And for all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Our guest is Brian Ingracia, a history professor here at MTSU and author of The Rise of Gridiron University, Higher Education's Uneasy Alliance with Big Time Football. My understanding, Brian, of the creation of the NCAA is that Teddy Roosevelt, who was rather progressive himself, called the university presidents together as these young men who were playing without helmets or with leather helmets were dying left, right, and center and said, look, you know, parents don't send their children to school, to college, to die playing a game. You either get a handle on this, or by God, the government will get a handle on it for you. Yeah. Is that roughly correct?
Well, there's some truth to that. What I would say is that, first of all, Teddy Roosevelt's role in most progressive era reforms has been overstated a little bit. And this is one where I think it is a little bit overstated. What happened is in the fall of 1905, there were a number of young men being injured or dying on college football fields, also on high school fields. And there were 18 young men who died in 1905 season. 15 of those were actually high school students. Only 3 were college students, but many times they were actually conflated in the newspapers. In October of 1905, Roosevelt called representatives from the Big Three, that's Harvard, Yale, Princeton, to the White House and said, you need to do something about this. We need to fix football. But really nothing much happened until November 1905, when there was a very, very bad day when at a game in New York, there was a player who died, I think, of a cerebral hemorrhage, and there was also a really nasty play in the Harvard-Yale game, which was very widely publicized. That was actually the thing that made the chancellor of New York University say, we need to do something about this. They called a meeting in New York in December. They started the forming of what later became the National Collegiate Athletic Association, which we usually say it began in January 1906. It's really December 05, January 06. So Teddy Roosevelt's part of the story, but if we stop with Roosevelt, we forget that there were all of these institutions, dozens of institutions around the country that really, they really wanted to save football and make it safe rather than seeing it either abolished or changed beyond recognition.
So like a lot of things pertaining to TR, the NCAA origin story sort of takes on a larger-than-life mythical tone to it.
Absolutely. And when I'm teaching here at MTSU, one of the things I always tell my students is, you know, the way that we tell the story of getting meatpacking reform is that Teddy Roosevelt was reading The Jungle and eating his breakfast sausages one day. And all of a sudden, he threw his breakfast sausages out of the window, says, oh, no, I've been poisoned. And then pure food and drug legislation gets passed. It's kind of representative of a larger truth, but it's not necessarily exactly what happened. He plays a role in that, in all these things, but it's not just one person making these things happen. It's Congress, it's university presidents, it's members of the public who are very concerned about this game that seems to be corrupting their universities the same way they're really concerned about, you know, the meatpacking plants that seem to be corrupting the meat that they're eating.
I would think that some progressives at the time were the ones calling for an end to football on campus altogether.
That's a good question. And there actually were some people we might consider progressives who are saying we should stop playing football. Some historians who've written about this, they really stress that Harvard's president at the time, Charles William Eliot, who actually was, he was getting towards the end of his career as the president of Harvard by this time, he really was saying we should get rid of this. There were a few muckrakers in magazines who were saying we should stop playing football. But for the most part, most of the university presidents, most of the professors, even a lot of politicians that we read about, rather than saying get rid of football, they said we need to fix it, or we need to replace it with another game that's also really strenuous and even brutal, but not as deadly for the young men who play it. There was even a really serious attempt to replace football with rugby in 1905, 1906, especially on the West Coast. And a lot of times when I tell people this, they say, wait a minute, but rugby is even more dangerous than football.
You're wearing no pads, no jocks, no nothing in rugby.
Exactly. And what you have to do is you have to go back and look at what the people at the time who promoted this reform said. And what they would say is, well, yeah, it's dangerous for your arms. It's dangerous for your legs. But it's not as dangerous for your brain, for your spine, for your central nervous system. They'd say, you might break an arm, but it's less likely that you're going to get a concussion or a broken spine in rugby. So for that reason, they would say it's actually a safer, better game that still gets across that kind of strenuous manliness, but doesn't kill young men in the process.
How do you relate, if at all, early attempts to make the game safe enough to play and safe enough to stay in college with the renewed concern today in the 21st century about concussions, both at the college and pro level?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, one of the things I always say about this is that any scandal that we see today, we can see in the 1890s or the early 1900s. And I think it's an open question. I'm not sure I have a reason why we're starting to talk about it again today. I think maybe because in some ways our political and social culture is similar to that of the early 1900s. I'm not sure if we're entering a new progressive era per se, but we certainly have kind of emerged out of we've been in the midst of a gilded age. And I think people are primed for looking around them, saying, what's wrong with our society? What can we do to fix it? And so we do have a lot of people talking about the concussions, the spinal injuries, like the one at Tulane back in the Tulane Tulsa game in September, where a player actually broke his spine. And I think people are really primed to talk about that and, you know, actually make changes in the game as opposed to just kind of sitting back and saying, well, you know, it's football. That's how it's going to be.
We'll have more with Dr. Brian Ingracia. After this is MTSU on the Record.
The MTSU Department of Art has the newest facility for visual arts in the state, with approximately 50,000 square feet of space, including high-tech computers and computer-driven equipment for multimedia, graphic design, printmaking, sculpture, painting, and ceramics. We feature a visiting artist lecture program and an exhibition program that exposes students to work by national and international artists. This is Jean Nagy, Chair of the Department of Art.
To find out more, visit mtsunews.com.
We're talking about college football with Dr. Brian Ingracia, who wrote The Rise of Gridiron University, Higher Education's Uneasy Alliance with Big Time Football. You might think of syndicated columnist George Will as more associated with baseball because of his book Men at Work, but George Will wrote a column in which he mentioned your book, Brian, extensively. Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
The reason why he found out about the book in the first place, I think, is a very simple one, is that the press actually sent him a copy and said, hey, take a look at this, and we'd love for you to write something about it. But it goes deeper than that. I think part of it is he grew up in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, and I wrote the first draft, we might say, of this book as my PhD dissertation at the University of Illinois. So there's a fair amount of Midwest Illinois stuff in there, and I think that captured his attention. But beyond that, I think what's interesting is that I do, in some ways, critique some of the things that the progressives were doing 100 years ago. I think that one of the problems with the progressives is they were trying to make long-lasting solutions to problems that were very particular to their time period. And what we see is that some of those solutions maybe haven't stood up over the test of, they haven't stood the test of time as well as we might think they would have. Well, I'm somewhat critical of the progressives in the book because, you know, there were some unintended consequences to the reforms they tried to make. George Will doesn't like progressives for maybe different reasons. He associates progressivism with the current president, Barack Obama. He doesn't like the current president or the idea of progressive politics. And so he took my kind of critique of some of the unintended consequences of progressivism and said, oh, well, this shows that in all contexts, progressive politics are a bad thing. So I'm going to use this book about football, which he's a little bit critical of college football anyway. So he liked that, and then he took that, and I think he took that to its logical conclusion, to a, critique current progressives. I would not have necessarily made that same argument, but George Will is a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post, and he's welcome to do that if he would like to do so.
But you didn't necessarily concur with everything he said in his column.
I think that's a kind way of putting it. But I'm very grateful that he did decide to devote a significant amount of space to talking about my book and the argument of the book.
Well, let's unpack this a little bit. One of his premises is, and I quote from Will's column, football taught the progressive virtue of subordinating the individual to the collectivity. Well, yes, it is a team sport, mm-hmm. You know, that's for sure. It almost sounds like he's trying to draw a connection between football and either collectivism, mm-hmm. as we learn in our political science classes, or even socialism.
Yeah, what I would say is that I think that football was created at a time where teamwork and discipline as a group was becoming more and more important. This was the time of industrialization in late 1800s America, right after the Civil War, especially in the 1870s, 1880s. This is the rise of huge industries, huge economies of scale, really. And football is kind of a game that comes out of that context. The progressive era, though, was all about fixing some of those problems that were brought about by industrialization and urbanization.
Child labor, no minimum wage, hard, hard work.
Absolutely. The progressives were trying to fix those things. And so football, I think, it reflects this kind of sense of, I wouldn't say collectivism, but this sense of harnessing the individual to the goal of a larger group. But that's not necessarily a progressive thing. That's more of what we might call a Gilded Age or an industrial thing. And I think the progressives, they saw some benefits of the game. They saw some benefits of economies of scale. And they said, well, instead of getting rid of this, let's fix it. And I would say maybe the way they fixed it wasn't the best way in the world. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they were all collectivists and that football is this game that teaches collectivism.
Not so much at the beginning of college football, but rather college football today in the 21st mm-hmm. century, I would be more likely to liken to capitalism run amok, especially mm-hmm. in Division I, rather than collectivism, socialism, or any other kind of ism.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And what you're saying, I think, is very correct in the sense that capitalism is about harnessing the power of the individual, the labor of the individual, the investment of the individual for a much larger purpose, which then a handful of people can make a lot of money off of. And, I mean, we see a good example of that, say, with a school that has a large football program, pays their coach for $5 million a year, and then that coach is able to extract that money. The university is able to make that money off the labor and efforts of a few, we might say, underpaid athletes. So in that sense, there is kind of a very capitalist element to what's going on, rather than a collectivist aspect.
One of the things he said was that football would reconcile the public to the transformation of universities, especially public universities, into something progressivism desired, but the public found alien. If he's talking about the social sciences, maybe I'm just thinking too 21st century-ish for my own good, but I found his notion that the creation of the social sciences would be alien to the American public. I really don't get that. Do you as a historian understand what he means there?
That's a good critique of Will's piece. I actually hadn't thought of it quite in those terms before. What I would say is that the social scientists were trying to understand what was going on. They were trying to understand shifts in American society. They were trying to understand the new ways that universities were relating to the public. And I think that at least that first generation of social scientists very much saw themselves as people who were part of the public and public intellectuals. And I don't think what they were trying to do was kind of to dupe the public into accepting certain tenets of collectivism or division of labor. I think they were just trying to understand it, and they kind of saw football as this game that made sense in the present order of things and people enjoyed, and it would be a way of kind of helping universities reach out in a very pragmatic way to those people. The more people you bring into a stadium, the more people who are going to come to campus and have maybe a better sense of what universities are trying to do. So yeah, I don't think they're necessarily separate from the public. I think over time, many professors in many disciplines become somewhat alienated from the public throughout the 20th century. But that doesn't mean that first generation of social scientists that thought football was a good thing, I don't think they're quite so alienated from the public as we might see in that piece.
And today, as you know, both academics and the general public, and certainly the press corps, know that you can view college football or any other sport through the prism of those social scientists, certainly economics, even political science, certainly medicine, law, even sociology.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more on MTSU on the Record right after this.
Expanding Your Horizons is an annual hands-on science and math conference for middle and high school girls. EYH enables girls to investigate careers in science and math and to talk with female leaders in those fields that are so essential to our nation's future. EYH also provides the girls with fun, hands-on activities and allows them to meet girls with similar interests. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, EYH Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Dr. Brian Ingracia, author of The Rise of Gridiron University, Higher Education's Uneasy Alliance with Big Time Football. He's a history professor here at MTSU. Brian, what do you think the Ivy League presidents and the social scientists of the early era of college football would say if they were alive today to witness college football as it is now, with its rituals of tailgating and boozing it up before the game and odds makers tempting people to, place wagers, legal or illegal?
That's a great question. I think many of them would be very, very horrified by what we have. I think the anthropologists maybe would say, oh, well, gambling is going to come along with a ritual like this. They might be very pragmatic about it. I think a very good example of this is that we actually see some of those progressive psychologists and social scientists actually starting to change their opinion over time as football became a much bigger ritual in the 1920s after World War I. There are several documented cases of people who thought football was really good in 1903 or 1905 or 1906, going back in the 1920s or 1930s and actually writing about football in a way that was very negative. And they say, well, we shouldn't have this here in our universities. This is corrupting them. There's too much money. At least one of these guys who back in 1905 said sport's a good thing. In 1930s, he said, oh, as early as 1905, 1906, I hated football and I thought it was a farce. So in some ways, they're even kind of revising their memory. And so I would think a lot of them, if they had a chance to look and see the injuries, the amounts of money, the amount of time and effort being put into the game, I think they'd be really, really horrified by it.
Do you think that the relatively egalitarian makeup of the student populations at universities in America today is attributable in part to college football, or would that be an overstatement?
I think that the widespread acceptance of university education as something that everyone should, or at least many people should aspire to do, I think that is partly a result of the late 1800s kind of broadening of the purpose of the university, that it's not just for teaching what we would call the liberal arts today, but it's for teaching any number of different subjects. And that is the environment in which football sports became a big part of universities. And I think that in that sense, we tend to today see universities as these institutions that appeal to every aspect of American life, to education, to research, to putting on a spectacle for the people. And I think athletics has had something to do with that. I grew up in a working class family where neither one of my parents had graduated from college. My father had not gone to college at all. To him, the University of Illinois was the football team and the basketball team. You know, I grew up in Illinois. And so I think that for people like my dad, you know, sports really is a way of identifying in some way with a big state university, for example, in a way that they couldn't if they don't actually go to campus, take the classes and things like that. So I don't know if it's necessarily widens out who's going to go to college, but it maybe kind of makes universities seem a little bit more relevant to a lot of those folks.
For all that we hear about basket weaving 101 and all of these alleged easy courses that student athletes get away with taking, there are some college students for whom athletics is their ticket in, and mm-hmm. once they get through the door of the university, then they do learn and they do have post-football careers, and they find that it does expand their mm-hmm. minds and their lives.
And I think that's, you know, athletic scholarships essentially at their best. I remember a few years ago having a debate with a friend of mine who said, he said something to the effect of, well, if you want to get rid of big-time athletics or big-time athletic scholarships, then that means there's a whole bunch of kids from underprivileged backgrounds who are not going to be able to go to college. And I said, no, why don't we just give scholarships to people based on academic merit or based on, we could give them randomly and some students would still have those opportunities. Now, I think it's great for athletes, people who are good at playing football or basketball or other sports, to be able to come to universities and not have to pay for it. But you might ask, is that the only reason why we could, you know, expand universities to a larger segment of the population? Could there be other ways of determining people who are worthy of getting scholarships and going to school?
Did you write this book, or were you inspired to write this book as a historian, or do you care specifically about the history of sports as sort of a subset of history?
That's a great question. I'm actually trained in what we would call cultural and intellectual history, and I actually started out being really interested in the history of higher education. That's where I actually come at this from. And at one point, I remember going to a football game and looking around and going, how did we get this? This is the only country in the world where universities sponsor big-time athletics, like football or basketball or whatever. And I said, how did this happen? And so I started doing the research into it. And definitely for me, sport is something that's kind of a subset of larger American history. Now, I am a sports fan. I got to admit, actually, my favorite sport is baseball. If I would have wanted to write a book about a sport I loved, I would have written about professional baseball. And I follow college football. But I wrote about it mostly because I wanted to understand how universities had embraced this ritual, and I really saw it as potentially a way for understanding the ways that universities, which are oftentimes seen as these ivory tower institutions, how they relate to the people who are not located on their campuses, who are not going to school there. And I started finding that people had been talking about this as long ago as 100 years ago.
The Rise of Gridiron University, Higher Education's Uneasy Alliance with Big-Time Football by Dr. Brian M. Ingracia. Thanks for being with us today, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.